The views and opinions expressed by host and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of the Global Liberty Alliance, its network, sponsors, donors, or broadcast platforms. The Global Liberty Alliance provides this podcast for informational purposes. Freedom of speech is a fundamental right and essential for free societies to prosper. Thank you for listening and supporting the mission of the Global Liberty Alliance, dedicated to strengthening and defending fundamental individual rights, free markets, and the rule of law.
Welcome to another Global Liberty Alliance podcast. I hope you're doing well. It's been a while. We've been off and on for a few months now, but we've started to pick up our programming again. And today we're going to start with Nicaragua. I'm coming to you from the free state of Florida, although we are still up in Virginia as well. But I'm broadcasting today from Florida, and we have a special guest from Texas, the vice president for the Initiative for Change, Justice, and Democracy. He's not only a guest, but he's a good friend, a liberty warrior formerly from Nicaragua, who has been working from Texas and has been fighting hard to not only talk about what's happening in his ancestral homeland, but also take action and find ways to connect with fellow liberty warriors here and in the region to advance the causes that we all care so much deeply about. We're recording Holy Week time. So this is a special Holy Week program, and we're going to start with what's happening in Nicaragua because it's the war and religious battles there. For those of you who listened to us before, about 3 years ago, we recorded a program with a Nicaraguan priest who was talking about the firebombings in Nicaragua. This was 3 years ago, this summer, and a lot has happened since we spoke to this priest. Everything that father said to us in that podcast came true, and then some. So, Roberto Bendaña, how are you doing? Welcome back.
Well, it's great to hear you, Jason. And yes, to our listeners, today on Holy Wednesday, I cannot but start and remember the verse of the Bible on the 28th of December of 2013, when I escaped the unjust regime of Daniel Ortega. That was almost 10 years ago, but it was Isaiah 41:10 that says, "Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. Amen. I will strengthen thee. Yeah, I will help thee. Yeah, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness." So, yes, it's great to be with you, Jason. It's been many years, you know, seeking for justice. I appreciate all the guidance and all the support that you have given me and given the Nicaraguan people, and obviously all the people, the Cuban and now the American, that we have a great threat with the Sao Paulo Forum and the Group of Puebla.
Let me ask you, Roberto, and again, thank you for joining us. I know you're extremely busy right now with the Initiative for Change and everything else you have going, but tell people a little bit about how you became a target of the Ortega Murillo regime in Nicaragua with folks. You know, folks, if you don't follow this too closely, I'm going to post some links about what's happening in Nicaragua so you could read up on it. But remember, this is part of the international left. So what's happening in Nicaragua is not just a Nicaragua issue. This is something that impacts us right here in the States. And the international left has Nicaragua as one of their battlegrounds. And Roberto paid a huge price for resisting that system. He still has some family in Nicaragua who has to be careful. But these are brave patriots. These are people who are not scared. And Roberto, beyond just talking about it, took action. But I think for the listeners, Roberto, can you tell them just briefly your how you came to this struggle and how you ended up starting this organization and why you did it?
Sure. And just like most of the Americans, you know, my history and my ancestors, my grandfather came in the early or the late 20s when he was 12 years old to live to New York. So he married a Lithuanian immigrant. She was born in the States, but her parents were Lithuanian immigrants. And then my father was born in New York. And then they moved, they relocated to Nicaragua when my father was 12 years old. So yes, my father married a Nicaraguan, and I was born in Managua, Nicaragua, but from a U.S. citizen. So I've always had my dual citizenship. And I give this introduction because, yes, my family has been persecuted for more than 40 years now. And my father was deported for being an American in 1981. And I do like to point out that one of my happiest days of my life was 1979, in the time of the revolution. And sometimes, you know, my friends and sometimes even my wife, they say, don't say that, you know, because people are going to relate you to the revolutionaries. But I mean, I need and I have to accept that at that time we were fighting, you know, or at least the Nicaraguan people, because I was only 14 or maybe 11 years old, a dynasty, a dictatorship of more than 40 years. So, and the Junta de Gobierno, the government, five people director or board, was made up of only two Sandinistas, part of the guerrillas that were armed. One was a literate person or academic coming from the academia, and two from the private sector. So I mentioned that because at this time, I think we in the United States need to be very, very careful because of the threat, again, that Sao Paulo Forum, the Group of Puebla, the leftists, the progressive movement is putting in the United States. And I mentioned this because 40 years ago in Nicaragua, you know, people were given the benefit of the doubt. And that's how Daniel Ortega, after being a communist dictator in the 80s, came back to power, you know, with only 38%, but also people, again, including private sector people, were given the benefit of the doubt that he was not the same of the 80s. And well, fast forward to nowadays, he has been accused of crimes against humanity. So we have known him, his nature. My father was part of, he was a witness to the International Relations Committee of the Senate in 1982, talking about human rights abuses and crimes against humanity of Daniel Ortega.
Yeah, your father, by the way, Roberto, your father has a great story also. He was from Texas, but he had a lot of business connections and family. He did a lot of work in Nicaragua, and that's how he met your mom, and that's how your family, that's how he got his start in the Nicaragua battles, and they targeted him, and they tried to steal his property. They stole some of his property. How has that changed from the time your father, I mean, does it sound like you're living history again, like what your dad went through, now you're going through?
Yes, and that's why, you know, after 40 years, sometimes I feel, you know, that we're back in starting point. Like you said, my father was the first Nicaraguan American, obviously because his father was a Nicaraguan, that had a PhD in plant physiology. So when he got his PhD, he went back to work with the land. He was a coffee farmer, and he obviously modernized the way to do agriculture, specifically coffee. And that's why in 1981, even though we supported, you know, or in the private sector supported the revolution, it quickly became, it was betrayed. The Sandinistas, again, backed by Cuba and Fidel Castro, they took control of the police and the army, and they did not work for a democratic society, but a communist government. So my father's colleague, another coffee farmer, Jorge Salazar, was killed. He was assassinated in November of 1980. And then the other private sector leaders were put in jail. Unfortunately, because my father was an American, he was put on the plane. He was deported. But yes, we have lived this. We went back to Nicaragua with free elections in the 90s. We recovered our properties that had been confiscated. And I remember I was just a university graduate from Texas A&M, but coming along with my father, wearing bulletproof vest in order to go to the farm because it was dangerous. Dangerous is really an understatement, because in January 1991, one of my uncles was killed going to the farm to steal $3,000, which was the payroll that day.
Wow.
And obviously it was more than just stealing stealing the money, but really sending a message, you know, that the people that were coming back to claim their farms and their property were not welcome. So that's part of the issue or the thinking that we have nowadays. Even, you know, if we are able to overthrow the Daniel Ortega regime, the security transition and the threat that people face going back, it's going to be very high.
You know, it sounds to me that the Sandinista system, because it's a system, you know, Daniel Ortega dies tomorrow, big deal. Murillo's not here tomorrow, big deal. It's a system. That's what I tell people that follow the Cuba issue. Okay, so what? Fidel Castro, he's gone. Raul's going to be gone soon. Big deal. It's the system they leave behind, and the system these people have put in place. And it sounds to me that in Nicaragua, they've been successful, is destruction. It's destruction because they need to build this communist society they're on a road to. And they're destroying three pillars. They're destroying private property. They're destroying individual rights. And they're destroying the family. So the family, you get the state. The institutions, there's many, primarily the churches, which we're going to talk about that in a minute. And of course, property rights, because they don't believe in private property. So to them, it's all, you know, it's a facade. It's a joke. They don't believe in it. They don't want it, even though they pay lip service to it. What happened? I mean, the Contras died. They bled. They fought. I grew up during the Cold War, and I knew Contras. I mean, I was born and raised in Miami, and I was surrounded by these soldiers that would come over to get medical care. We met a lot of the generals that were fighting in the battlefields of Nicaragua. Was that in vain? I mean, why did they fight that battle? And are we back there? I mean, what happened then? I know it's a horrible time in Nicaragua's history. Yet I hear these stories that you're sharing with us. I hear this from other people. I talk to a lot of religious in Nicaragua, like bishops and priests from the Catholic Church. They tell me things that I'm thinking, wait a minute, we already fought these battles. It sounds like we're fighting them again. Is that true?
Yes. And that's why I keep raising the issue of the Sao Paulo Forum, which was founded by Fidel Castro and Lula da Silva, who is back in power in Brazil. And obviously with Daniel Ortega, this was in the 1990s when the Cold War ended, you know, and they didn't have the support of Russia. So like you said, you know, the Sandinistas is not just a system in Nicaragua. It is part of the transnational organized crime. And the Sao Paulo Forum and the Grupo de the Puebla group are part, you know, they are financed with that organized crime, dirty, bloody money. So they're obviously infiltrating in the United States. They already financed our electoral campaigns in Spain, and they're all over in Latin America. I just participated in a Madrid Forum meeting in Lima, Peru last week. Fortunately, you know, the Lima people, they were able to stand the attempt, you know, of President Castillo trying to cancel the whole Congress. So it is a system that it is in place, and that's why I keep on saying that we cannot give the benefit of the doubt, because they're working very smartly and not with weapons and arms anymore. Now they're working with the electoral processes and the electoral systems.
So let me ask you a question about that, and this will be a mini lightning round. I tend not to do these, but I just want to get some issues clear for the listeners and ask you a few questions and just see if you could just answer yes or no on this. Is there rule of law in Nicaragua?
Definitely not.
They control the
judicial system. Yeah, I'm sorry.
So is there an independent Congress that has the democratic processes protected?
Definitely not.
Is there an opposition in Nicaragua?
Definitely not.
So why do we have American politicians, for example, and I'll pick on the Biden administration now because they're the ones in power, but this goes equally for Republicans. Roberto and I have talked a lot about this over the years, and this is not a Democrat or Republican issue because both parties have failed on helping the people of Nicaragua. We had an opportunity many years ago, and Roberto will talk about that in a minute, to support a movement that frankly surprised me, the intensity of it. Not that it was not going to happen. I had confidence it would happen. And we just pretty much turned our back on it. And this week, and I think President Trump, by the way, was poorly advised on Latin America. I think if he had been advised properly, we would have had a better policy, but he was given bad advice. But he had his heart in the right place. And I know if he had been given the right advice, he would have taken different recommended actions down there. But just 2 weeks ago or so, over 200 political prisoners were freed. And the Biden administration praised this move. Of course, today we're learning that the whole thing's backfired on them. Why are they surprised that any of this would backfire on them? I mean, don't we know if there's no private property rights, there's no religious freedom in Nicaragua, there's no Congress, there's no opposition. It's pretty much, as Roberto has said, a system that has now used the law as a cover to institutionalize the system. That is what these people are doing. So why do American policymakers from both political parties who think that sanctions are a policy, which they're not, sanctions are tools, think it's any different now? Why do they negotiate with this guy? Should we negotiate with this guy? And then I know I'm throwing a lot at you, but I know this part of your answer is going to include this. When people say the private sector in Nicaragua, what does that mean and how does it factor into all of this? Because it plays a pretty big role.
Yes. So let me start with the private sector. Before that, and before I forget, when you were talking about the judicial system and the legislative system, I wanted to give another example to put people into perspective. There were, after the general elections of 2021, there were elections in November of 2022 were municipal elections, electing the city mayors. And the Electoral Council, which is obviously not all Sandinista, they assigned to themselves 100%. So, I mean, they don't even try, you know, to make it seem reasonable. They got all the cities, all the municipalities now. So that's just to, again, put into perspective and an example. And that's what we've been also making a point, you know, that we cannot, and the U.S., you know, the Nicaragua government did not accept the proposal for the ambassador that they were sending. So how is the U.S. government allowing, you know, to have a Nicaraguan ambassador here? So, yeah, we've been saying, you know, that it is an illegitimate.
Well, I mean, you're saying so much, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's important to remind folks of something else. Roberto spent time on a hunger strike many years ago in Nicaragua. He had a pup tent. Okay, a Coleman, one of those Coleman pup tents that you go camping in front. Yeah. I think it was the Electoral Commission. I think they're equivalent.
It was the same.
Yeah, yes, yeah, yes. They're equivalent to the FEC. And the only thing Roberto was asking for, the only thing, well, he asked for a few things, but the one big thing he was asking for, just transparent elections, voter rolls that everybody can take a look at, and let's hold elections in a transparent way. What the heck happened then? Because it sounds to me, again, Roberto, it's happening again. You can't have free and fair elections in a police state. So why did the Biden administration and some Trump administration officials, not all of them, again, I doubt the president was given good advice. In fact, I know he wasn't given good advice. So what is it? Why do we keep repeating these mistakes? You had a very good plan. Get these voter rolls in order. Get this stuff on the books. Get the municipal elections going. Elect good people. They you can't do that in Nicaragua because the bad people, the communists, control the voter system.
Exactly. Yeah. And that hunger strike was in 2012. So that was after I had experienced two electoral frauds in 2008, which were municipal elections, and in 2011, which were general elections. So again, after 2008, in 2012, municipal elections were coming. So this was for the third time. All the judges or the board of the Electoral Council, their terms were already over, were due. So I remember we had a banner that said Rivas or waiver. So we were obviously also sending a message to the United States, do not give Nicaragua the waiver. The waiver is an instrument, you know, that is given from the State Department when the country is walking towards democracy. So we're saying, you know, they should get rid of all those corrupt judges. And if they do, then give them the waiver. If not, don't give them the waiver. But they did. And as you're saying, it is unfortunate because I come back again to Grupo Puebla and the narrative of the progressives. We're just, you know, allowing little by little to these people to present themselves as if they're Democrats, as they're Democratic. And before I forget, this is one of the struggles we're dealing within the Nicaraguan opposition, because in the opposition, there is hardcore Sandinistas that present themselves as civic or democratic. But in the 80s, they also committed crimes against humanity, just like Ortega. And they are the ones leading the opposition. Why? Because the U.S. government and the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute is giving them the money to be able to mobilize, to be able
to go. So, all right. So hold on a minute. You're saying U.S. taxpayer money.
Yeah.
The money you and I pay to the IRS every April coming up.
Yes.
And Americans have taken out of their paycheck by the Congress every month.
Exactly.
Is going to fund what? People who are pretty much at odds with us? Why is the IRI, the International Republican Institute, doing such a thing?
Well, and it has been one of my weaknesses or defects that I have presented myself as a Republican, you know, since I am a teenager. You know, Ronald Reagan, Oliver North, they were heroes. They were able, you know, to provide help for the freedom fighters in Nicaragua. And obviously now, you know, people label us as being extreme right or radicals, all because we say things like they are, you know, and that's why I talked about the junta de gobierno, the government board in 1979 that was made up of five people. So the two that represented the private sector were betrayed. And this is what we don't want to repeat. You know, I'm envisioning that if we are able to overthrow the regime, there can be a transitional board again, but I don't want the leftist or the progressive to betray us. And then they go, you know, with their socialist relation, which they don't hide, because there was a Gioconda Belli, who is a feminist writer, just supporting the communist candidate in Spain last week. So they don't hide it, but they're
wait,
here.
Wait, what do you mean? You mean they were at a conference that you were at?
No, they weren't in Lima, Peru, but she was in a political campaign. I think in a couple of months, Madrid is going to have their elections.
Oh, I don't know if it's all municipal. No, I got
about
it.
Spanish.
It. Right.
Yeah, no, about Spanish election.
Yeah. So no, and this is happening, by the way, folks, not just in Latin America. It is happening in Spain, and it's all connected, like Robert's saying, with the Foro Sao Paulo. And we're going to have a show just on that, hopefully soon, with a few people, because it's an interesting long term issue that folks don't talk about as much as they used to, but they should, especially now that Lula, the little pet of the international left, is, back in power, criminalizing and doing who knows what with Brazil's economy right now and their political system. On Nicaragua, though, back to the IRI 1 minute. Do you think that any of these programs funded by U.S. taxpayers are useful? We throw all this money at all these groups. We've been doing this for decades. Has it helped any? I mean, these 200 people were allegedly released. What did we get for that? I mean, that's pretty much, and in Cuba, something similar happened. Cuba's pretty much purged anybody, for the most part, that was left of a new opposition, of a new resistance to the system. They did it in a very clever way after the July 11 uprisings a few years ago. We pretty much turned our back on those people. And Republican Democrats, as usual, very good about social media and Viva Cuba Libre stuff, whatever, but nothing happened. And Cuba won, the Communist Party won, people were purged, chapter over, system won. Do you think something similar has happened in Nicaragua with this recent release? I mean, I have a bishop that will go unnamed because he has asked me not to name him, who has documented a lot of gross violation of human rights in Nicaragua. I think they come to the point of crimes against humanity, targeting of Catholics and other Christians in Nicaragua, that in his opinion, and the team that's advising him and documenting these cases, is systemic. They are purging Christians, Catholics, you name it, out of Nicaragua. Their goal, of course, is to destroy the Catholic Church, to destroy Christianity. They don't care one iota about religious freedom. And in Nicaragua, something I haven't seen in Cuba yet, although they do attack the church in Cuba every day, but in Nicaragua, they've gone after, I mean, they've locked up bishops, priests, then they release all these people. Is taxpayer money going to the right groups to help stop this, or is it making it worse? What exactly has America been doing to stop these sort of atrocities from happening in Nicaragua?
Well, obviously, it's very hard because I cannot, or it's difficult for me, you know, to say don't help the Nicaraguan people, which obviously do need help, but obviously most of the money it's going to finance the I want to say the wrong people, but yes, with the wrong intentions, and And when, you know, people from my group you know, what we try to present a more straightforward, I don't want to use the word radical, is just, you know, saying things as they are. And one of the things that comes to my mind when you were talking is that you have always said, you know, that the U.S. market is not a right. You know, it is a privilege.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Basic things like those, we've been saying, you know, suspend CAFTA, sanction the Nicaraguan army that has committed crimes against humanity. There is definitely a harsher and more direct and effective sanctions or actions, like taking away, you know, the ambassador from Nicaragua. Just like you said, you know, when they brought, and this was obviously a negotiation between the U.S. government and the Nicaraguan regime, when they brought the 222 political prisoners into the United States, that same day, I think Secretary Blinken and Undersecretary Brian Nichols, they were celebrating. Yes, we're happy for their freedom, but they were saying, oh, this is a sign of a dialogue. And you know, there is a willingness of the government. They call them government and not regime, illegitimate regime and criminal. But next day, they were taking away the nationalities of those 222. And then a week later, they took away the nationalities of 94. And I was included. I was number four on the list of that 94 Nicaraguan American. And in my case, just Nicaraguan American, but in the case of the other one, just Nicaraguan, that were outside Nicaragua. We were already in exile, and they keep, you know, persecuting us. So and they didn't count on Bishop Rolando Alvarez from Matagalpa, that he did not get on the plane. He said, you know, I'm not going. And so he stayed. And what happened within the week? Obviously, you know that there is no due process at all in Nicaragua. What happened? He was sentenced to 26 years to prison. You know, two more years. They sentenced me to 24. They sentenced Rolando Alvarez to 26 years in prison.
Well, you were first, though. I got to tell people, Roberto probably doesn't want me to say this, but Roberto was on the front lines when nobody else in the diaspora or in Washington, all these self-anointed Washington, D.C. elites who think they can dictate Nicaragua policy from D.C. armchairs. Roberto was on the front lines when nobody else was doing this. He was the canary in the coal mine. He was out there forcing the issue on the streets. Why didn't people listen? And I know you weren't the only one. You've told me about some other great patriots who were working with you. It didn't need to get to this point. You know, they weren't attacking the church the way they were attacking, you know, what's happening to the Catholic Church and other Christian churches today. I agree with Bishop, that bishop that I can't name, that
Rolando Alvarez. Yeah.
He's another one. Bishop that I promise I wouldn't name him, but I agree with him. These are crimes against humanity. They are attacking Catholics and Christians for their faith. You were out there before this level of, I think when you started to engage on this issue on the electoral front, if people had paid attention to what you were saying, and there had been some common sense focus of our money being spent down there, you know, you can affect a lot of change in places like Nicaragua with very little money and a lot of effort. And there's a lot of effort on your part and some other people from Masaya, just all over the place that wanted to do something. And then 18th of April comes. The movement a few years later, by then you had to get out of there. These people were chasing you down. You probably would have been killed down there. Mm-hmm. Then the student uprising happened. I thought, okay, here we go. It finally happened. My government would wake up. Our government would wake up. We're going to back these people. Again, nothing. And here we are again. The situation is worse today, right? Or not? How is it? And why does all this stuff, Roberto, We're talking about Roberto Bendaña, by the way, folks, with the Initiative for Change, Justice, and Democracy. Why should Americans even care about this? Like, is it something that happens in Central America and we could move on? Which you and I both know that's not true, but why should we care and why should we keep spending money on these programs?
Well, I always like to link it and relate it to the immigration issue, because unfortunately, it's also part of the transnational organized business. You know, Daniel Ortega is allowing Cubans to fly in from Havana to Managua. And I know this because I live in Texas, and I have talked to people that have traveled by land that pay $10,000 to coyotes. And obviously those coyotes are part of the organized crime. So the Cubans are flying for $4,000 from Havana to Managua. And then together with Nicaraguans, they get on the journey. You know, once they get to Mexico, a commercial plane is waiting for them, and even resident IDs, Mexican IDs, to be able to get on that plane to fly to the northern border.
Wow.
And then they were obviously surrendering themselves to the Custom Border Patrol, and they were able to enter here. So that again, it's one of the things, you know, Nicaragua, Honduras, they're making a business, not just through the organized crime, but then those people that come here, I guess, yes, you know, refugees fleeing from the harshness, not just the governance, but also the economic harshness of the countries. They send remittances to back to their countries, which obviously helps in the economy. So that's why, and I remember talking once to you that you weren't so sure of the popularity that the U.S. and obviously it's what the U.S. represents, you know, the freedom, the democracy, free enterprise, how popular it is back in our countries. You know, some people might think, well, you know, people over there are socialists, people that's what they want. They voted in Ortega, so that's what they should get. But again, no, it's part of corrupt transnational organized crime system that tries to play democracy. Now it's not with the weapons, like I mentioned before. Now is trying to play democracy. Well, and you have lived it, and you have witnesses, and you have studied the example of Cuba, which is a one party. You know, so what kind of elections can you have with one party system? And Nicaragua is basically the same. Unfortunately, the big difference with Nicaragua is that there is still three or four private banks, but they are also kidnapped, you know, to the system. You know, what is happening? Just to give you an example, they are getting money from the deposits, you know, from their clients, but instead of lending the money to small enterprises or medium businesses, they're lending it to the government, to the central bank, and to the Ministerio de Hacienda, you know, to the finance ministry. So they are using people's deposits, people's monies, to lend it to the illegitimate criminal regime. And I guess there's nothing, quote unquote, they could do, because they're not brave enough to just leave the country. That's what they should do. You know, and unfortunately, yes, we've also called for I'm trying to think of the word in English.
A general strike,
but where you don't pay the taxes, you know, where you don't obey an illegitimate and criminal government.
Well, let me ask you something, because the students of the 18th of April Uprising,
uh-huh.
I think they were well on their way of probably achieving that if
yes,
if they had had the backing, because correct me if I'm wrong, Roberto, but didn't that movement eventually result in almost a national stop of like even traffic coming in from both sides of the country? I mean, was it getting serious that the country would have had a general strike across the board in commerce?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I think for a month or almost 2 months, I don't recall exactly, they had the whole traffic stopped, so that there was no commerce. And unfortunately, you know, again, you know, the politicians, the diplomats, that they supported a dialogue, they gave the benefit of the doubt, the private sector trying to continue doing business. And that's the tactic that unfortunately they use. And it's the same in Cuba, it's the same in Venezuela, it's the same in Nicaragua. You know, they support the opposition, they give them money to go to the UN and put their...
So basically, let me ask you, I don't want to name names because we're not going to do that on this show. But are there people, because I know Ortega's a bad dude, whatever. I know the Sandinistas are not good news. I know that. But what really gets under my skin sometimes are these so-called people in the private sector. I think some of them are oligarchs who use their position with of great wealth. You know, rather than do good with it, they feather their bed with these communists, and they play this bizarre little game that they pretty much support an opposition, but only, I call it a Potemkin opposition. It's not real opposition. It's just to give the impression of an opposition. And for a few, you know, a few pieces, you know, some money here and there, they'll do enough opposition to keep Uncle Sam happy in Washington, D.C. But the moment you step out to go after them, and I've been a strong advocate, and you know this, of sanctioning those people, we have to go after the oligarchs. I could care less about the Sandinistas. To me, I know they're bad news. They don't care about sanctions because most of them could care less about money. Most of them are on a long march to create communism. I think we have to sanction these oligarchs and these people who want to have their cake and eat it too. Do you think that's too radical, or do you think we have to go after those people also?
Well, you know, I agree. I mean, I, definitely, yes. However, I think it's even simpler because obviously, you know, my family, we come from the private sector, and we had, you know, the private sector, the ambassador, Bob Callahan, he met with the private sector and we had conversations. So what I'm trying to suggest, if the U.S. ambassador or any U.S. official tells these oligarchs that they're going to be sanctioned, they don't even need, you know, to be sanctioned just by sending the message. But unfortunately, they're not.
So you're basically saying that we haven't had a U.S. ambassador with some
political U.S. ambassador.
Moral courage, just moral courage, maybe.
Moral courage, yeah. And that's why, you know, that's why I named Ambassador Callahan, because since himself, which is obviously 12 years ago, we had three ambassadors that are diplomats, you know, that are career diplomats. They only care for their career. You know, they're not stepping up to the plate. You know, they're not doing what they really should be doing. And what I'm trying to say also, you cannot fight a criminal and transnational organized crime regime with politics and diplomacy. It's not going to happen.
I mean, do we need to put together a movement, a liberty movement that politically can take these people on inside of Nicaragua. I mean, we have to do it inside the country. And by the way, folks, when we say oligarchs, we're not saying every private person in Nicaragua. We're talking about just two or three people, two or three people who think that they're like something out of the Spanish conquistadors or something. They're living in another century. And we've kind of coddled that behavior. America's partly to blame for that because, as Robert says, we haven't had an ambassador down there. I think we could have had one during the Trump administration. Again, if President Trump had been properly advised on Nicaragua, we would have had another type of ambassador maybe, or another movement down there. But we defaulted to this position. Oh, let's impose a bunch of sanctions and have a bunch of press releases and speeches here in Washington. But when it comes to pushing product in Nicaragua, we don't do it. But do you, what do we need to do as we're getting close to the end of the podcast? We want to leave some folks with some good news, some action items. What can we do? What should we be thinking about as we head into what I think is a very dark and difficult phase for the people of Nicaragua? Because if more than 200 of potential opposition leaders have been kicked out, the Catholic Church, which is still a powerful force in Nicaragua, is having some of their top people locked up. What do the folks who are left behind, or the folks like in your groups, we're fighting to create this movement to help in Nicaragua, What can people do? What should we be doing? And where should we be focusing our energy?
Okay. The first thing is, since now not only the OAS, but now the UN had a report identifying, finding crimes against humanity from the regime, is take it to the International Penal Court and obviously, take Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo and all of their accomplices to the International Court of Justice. But also, because that obviously is going to take time, we and the United States also should, declare illegitimate, not call it a government, and obviously do not allow, the World Bank, the IDB, even the Central American Bank of Integration, CABE, to finance the government. To finance the government. And then number three, there is the mining sector. There is the banking sector that we've been talking about, the electricity and the gasoline sector, that are the ones that making all the money. Sanction them. Also sanction the army investments, which are here in the United States. They have all their investments, all their pensions, their retirement money here in the U.S. And that would definitely send a direct signal. And then to the opposition, we cannot continue NDI and IRI financing the progressive movements, the leftist movements. We should allow, the campesinos, the farmers, the leaders come from the rural sector that are the majority, that are the conservatives, really give them a voice. And that way they can also, you should find ways to send those people monies, that the ones that remain in Nicaragua that are in the rural sector, to give them the possibility to continue, with different strikes. And we're talking obviously about civic strikes, like we mentioned before, not pay the taxes, disobey, obviously, the laws. Just keep on give them hope, and some type of opportunity. And not just money for again, the leftists and the progressive to go around the world taking pictures, denouncing and not nothing happening. There is definitely several actions that can be much more effective and less costly. Less costly to the U.S. government.
Exactly. No, we've been talking to Roberto Ventana, Initiative for Change, Justice and Democracy Vice President. It's a wonderful group that's come together to put some liberty warriors on the front lines and accomplish projects like the one he's talking about here. Roberto, as we wrap up, we have to We have to move on. Time flew by, as always. When we get together, we can talk for hours probably about these issues. The rule, it's important that the folks understand what Roberto just said there, that the voices for change, the people who need the support, are in Nicaragua. They are folks who, a lot of them come from very humble backgrounds, but they're hardworking. They're liberty-focused people. They want private property. They want to be left alone. And we've been contacted by a lot of them over the years, and they're just frustrated. And even the mosquito, the different mosquito tribes, the native tribes, have started to reorganize. And a lot of these movements of workers and property owners and farmers, and co-ops, that's where the change is coming from, not from Managua. Those are the people who want action, not the people in Managua or Washington, D.C., or Miami, or here. It's just not happening. And Roberto has family there, and he still has businesses there. And I want folks to understand he's taking a big risk by talking about this, but he feels so passionate about it, and he's connected still to that land, to these people, to the country that he knew as a child, and then he became an American, and he's has a special relationship. He goes back and forth, and that's something that's pretty remarkable about the Western Hemisphere, is that we can have these great back and forth special relationships with our ancestral homelands. Of course, some of us can't, because we can't go to places like communist Cuba because they won't allow it. And Roberto can't go to Nicaragua because they'll probably lock him up again or worse. So yeah. Think about that, folks, that a lot of what's happening here in this country is happening down in Nicaragua. I think you're seeing a reawakening, Roberto, of a total new political class. And that makes me optimistic and hopeful for some good stuff coming. Don't you think, or do you think I'm oversimplifying it?
No, again, I mean, it's so sad to see here in the United States how politicians are using the judiciary system to get rid of political opponents.
That's the stuff that happens down where you come from.
Exactly. Well, it has happened in Nicaragua for so many years, and you never thought that you would see it here in the United States. So that's why, you know, they're not going to silence me. In Spanish, we have a saying, you know, that we have lost so much that we have even lost our fear. Mm. Yeah.
And the Nicaraguan people have lost their fear too. You're seeing the reawakening down there.
Exactly. So yeah, and in the rural sector again, you know, those people, they're not even, you know, the political persecution again is crime. They're killing them, and the police obviously, and the judiciary system make it seem like it's an ordinary crime. You know, like if it was for theft or something else.
Yeah.
So there is even worse, and that's why they're even more desperate. But yes, thank you so much, Jason, for the opportunity, and we're definitely going to continue supporting the work the GLA is doing, and because, as I mentioned in the beginning, you're not only supporting Nicaragua, but you're supporting the whole world, you know, that have American hostages all over the world. So we continue this fight for liberty and justice.
Well, we'll keep going, Roberto. Roberto Bandania, thank you so much for joining us today from Texas. You're always welcome here. And my best to your family here and in Nicaragua. All the best, and have a blessed Easter.
You too. God bless you, Jason.